A king was considered to be a sacred person. In fact, on page 442, Bousseau said this: "It appears that the person of the king is sacred, and that to attack him in any way is sacrilege." Now, you know, we are almost that bad in some churches about the pastor. You can't say anything about some of these church leaders because that'd be sacrilege.
Yeah.
Well, do you think Price would look kindly on anybody questioning him in any way?
Oh,
no.
He'd have him fascinated. Take him out.
The royal throne is not the throne of a man, but the throne of God himself. Kings should be guarded as holy things, and whosoever neglects to protect them is worthy of death. The royal power is absolute, and the prince need render account of his acts to no one. This is the basis of a dictator. 442. It's right on the right hand side there. And the prince need render account of his acts. Where the word of the king is, there is power. Without this absolute authority, the king could neither do good nor repress evil. Now, that's the reason that they were so adamant about putting down any kind of a rebellion, any kind of popular uprising. Now, into this, we have the church, the Catholic Church we are referring to. And he talks about Louis the 14th. When Henry died, Henry the 4th in France, his son, a small boy of 9, came to the throne, Louis the 13th. And during that time, there was a Cardinal Richelieu. And Richelieu was the power behind the throne. I'm sure you understand that a little boy of 9 years old is not going to run a country. Somebody has to run the country. And it fell to this cardinal, and he was one mean dude. I mean, he was something else. He was the protege of the Queen Mother. And he was the real power in France. And under Richelieu's direction, the structure of absolutism quickly took shape. Castles of the nobility were torn down. Officials of the central government called intendants replaced the nobility as the chief administrators. Well, after the deaths of Richelieu and Louis, the 13th. Then we had Louis the 14th come to the throne. But he found that the people had been put into a very subservient attitude. Now, remember what has happened in in Iran. There was an uprising that overthrew the government of Iran. And there was a man that came to power by the name of Mossadegh. And Mossadegh began to nationalize the oil field. The idea being that the oil of Iran belonged to the people, not to the oil company. And so it was then that Exxon, Chase Manhattan, and some of these powerful organizations in this country were hurt financially by what happened in Iran under Mossadegh. So they, through the CIA, set out to overthrow Mossadegh and put in the Shah, the young Shah, he's a young man at that time, 30 years ago, his name was Pahlavi. And the Shah was put back in power, or the idea of a Shah was put back in power. He had not been, he was the heir to the throne. And it was then that he decided to raise the prices of oil. The price that you're paying at the gas pump right now is directly traceable to the Shah. It was during this time that the Rockefellers, who own Exxon, and the State Department that was run by Henry Kissinger, who has always been a protege of the Rockefellers, he would not go along with the Saudi Arabia, who wanted to cut the price of oil and keep the price of oil down. And it was the Shah that kept adding on and adding on. And the Saudi Arabians begged the United States to step in and do something. Because after all, we had put the Shah in power, we had supported him, and we ought to have some say-so about what he was doing. But instead, Kissinger and the Rockefellers were making their fortune. And as a result, we had what, we had what's going on right now. The Shah had what was called a sabat, which was the secret police. You could be arrested, you could be put in a holding cell, held years, tortured, and
to my knowledge, the people that they have in Nazis before they were taken, what was their position or whatever, what were they doing?
Well, they worked at the embassy. They were embassy employees. No. You see, every country has a place for governments to be represented. And it's called, you appoint an ambassador. Well, you have to have a staff to operate that embassy. And every embassy is protected by Marines. In other words, when you go in, you have to identify yourself and pass a Marine guard. But usually you have like four, five, six Marines, and then they alternate. And it's really a very plush appointment for a Marine because, you know, they are always holding parties and so forth. And they are, you know, kind of part of the embassy staff. And then, of course, you have secretaries and you have maintenance personnel. Now, in other words, these are all Americans that were working for the American government on American soil. Remember, the Iranian embassy in on Embassy Row in Washington, D.C., is part of Iran. It's not part of the United States. The Japanese embassy is part of Japan. And that land is considered as much a part of Japan as Tokyo is. And that's the reason that we have now gone to the United Nations and today to the World Court to try to bring world pressure. Of course, we're not doing very well because Japan is buying up all the oil at inflated prices that Iran will produce.
Oh, we were buying.
Yeah, well, and anything that any other country will let go of.
Well, but they were being paid by the United States.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. These are the United States employees. They're United States citizens.
Did you hear that I heard last time at 11:30, I watched the latest. I got the impression it hurt, you know, that Carter said that you only got 10 days.
What?
No, I didn't.
Well,
D- There are people that are trying to get him to do that. In other words, to set an ultimatum. But I don't think that'll work. We're dealing with crazy. No, they're not. In fact, they interviewed, NBC interviewed this Marine Gallegos last night. And he said, what hostages that I can see are about 20. And, you know, that's all that he has contact with. And he was one of the Marines.
If they would have a lot of fighter planes and things kind of swarming around that place and tell them we're coming in there, and all they know they have to do is die, I think they'd let them go.
Well, the only thing is,
not they're going to drop this kind of swarm over the top.
They just swarm over them like that. They got that kind of gun.
Yeah, they have our aircraft.
Sure, see,
we gave them our most sophisticated fighters.
Ooh.
And trained their people to operate them. Yeah, we still have Iranian soldiers in this country that we're training. We cut off the training supposedly, but they're still in this country, and they are Iranian soldiers that were sent over here to train to use the weapons that we have supplied them. Well, the decisions were made a long time ago, bad decisions. Henry Kissinger was not a very smart man. You know, a professor that has never learned to speak without an accent living in this country all this time is not that brilliant as far as I'm concerned. And to me, Kissinger made look at Vietnam. Boy, I fixed Vietnam. Yes, he did. Look at what Cambodia, we kept saying that once one falls, the domino theory, I stood on the deck of the Blue Ridge, and one of the officers saw me. This is where we threw off all of those helicopters. Do you remember how they would fly those helicopters out there and unload them, and then just push those $1 million deals out into the ocean? Well, we were warned that this would happen if we let the Shah back in here and do it. There's no sense in letting that guy in this country.
Well, what are you going to do when the guy hands you a suitcase of money? Is it just for you?
Well, I've had people try to bribe me. You know, a suitcase full of money. But, you know, start liquor stores close to where I was. I've been offered.
Every month.
But at least they haven't hit my price yet. I'll put it out. I don't know. Maybe somebody's going to hit my price, but so far they haven't.
Yeah.
Well, this Louis the 14th, now when you go to Paris, one of the places that you'll go, no doubt, is to the Louvre, which is one of the world's largest museums. That's where Leonardo da Vinci's paintings and so forth are, sculptures. And it's just a large, beautiful building. And this had always been the place where the royalty lived. This was the palace. But it wasn't good enough for Louis the 14th, and he took a swamp outside of Paris called Versailles. And he built the Palace of Versailles, and it, you know, the Hall of, that's where the Versailles Treaty was signed after World War I. And it is just unbelievable, the gardens and, you know, and so forth. But of course, today it's not used as a palace. It's just used as a showpiece. Yeah, that's it. And, you know, that's...
Is it a full place he built out there in the swamp?
Yeah. Well, just imagine what they... Now, we're talking about a thing. Now, here's a country that is constantly at war with Spain and England and so forth, and then to gut the nation financially with that kind of a business, you know, that's just ridiculous. You know, you can just use one bathroom at a time, you know. you can just use one bedroom at a time. But I've been to the Palace of Versailles on different occasions. Good night. It's just unbelievable. The rooms and the, everything about it. Oh, yeah. This is where, you know, when the mob came out, that Marie Antoinette was living there, and she said, what's the matter with them? Well, they want bread. Well, let them eat cake. You don't have bread, you don't have cake. But you see, when you lose complete touch with people. See, that's the thing I can't understand. We were talking about Reverend Ike. That's the thing I can't understand about people sitting there and allowing themselves to be ripped off. And, you know, doing nothing about it.
Glorying in it.
Yeah. At least when I pull into a service station and have to pay $1.05, $1.06 for gas, it just about kills me.
Yeah,
and it makes me want to run for president or something.
Well,
so bad.
I was driving out Longview Boulevard yesterday. You know, he's a Jet 77 station off Raymond Gulf. And I get some lift. I know this people do. You can sit safe to our street. And I run in and got the thing and stayed in my gas. How much this gas? He said, about 14. I said, more people buy gas units over there. He said, well, crazy. You know, how much this gas over there?
Eight. Yeah. Well.
And it's because the chief paid the guy to the gas higher.
Right there on. Right by my house, there is a Shell station, a Union station, and a Standard station.
Mm-hmm.
Union is $1.15. Shell is $1.12. And Chevron is $1.03. And people are going in these other stations. And I don't dig that at all. But anyway, that's... And like you say, there's one of those
big sign.
Well, this is called
77. It says 57 cents.
Well, this is called
double.
Oh yeah, this is called thrifty.
Yeah,
over there by my house, and it's $1.09, but Chevron is $1.03, just a block away.
I don't know a guy that owns oil company. Then you just go get your car and I go in there to more gas.
Gary, I don't know if you're an honorable preacher or not. Could you introduce me to
him? Well, you had to drive all the way down there to get it.
Oh, well.
I'll let him use my car.
Well, maybe you could arrange for me to be called to Bakersfield. See, he's not getting me to church like he promised, so maybe you can. All right, now. Again, here was a man that ruled absolutely. But the same thing happened in England. Now, remember that we talked about James the First. Now, James the First was the son of Mary Stuart. He is the one that brought about the King James Version of the Bible. And it says about him that he lacked common sense. He was the wisest fool in Christendom. He again advocated the divine right of kings. In his first address to Parliament, he got up and he said, "The state of monarchy is the supremest thing upon earth. For kings are not only God's lieutenants upon earth and sit upon God's throne, but even by God himself they are called gods. That as to dispute what God may do is blasphemy." You ever hear a preacher, you know, "Boy, you go against me and you're blaspheming the Holy Ghost," or something? Well, that won't work.
Oh, sure.
That just won't work. You've been telling them out there.
I've been trying. Kneel when you walk in.
Yeah. Now, that, you know, that's what William does. When they come, they stay on their knees in prayer until the service. In a curry night here?
Yeah.
You know William, my big boy?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. That's where William conducts his service.
He's still on his knees.
The whole congregation. Okay.
Only two.
Until he calls them to order and they start serving. That way they go walking around, socializing. So fraternizing. Well, I don't know if I thought about it.
I'm going to keep my church. I ain't going to try.
Yeah, I'm kind of like Luther. I don't think that these people would put up with it.
Something
Get them on their knees when you call them, Lord.
No. So is its addition in subjects to dispute what a king may do in the height of power. I will not be content that my power be disputed upon. You don't know preachers like that. You haven't been around very much. But anyway, there developed then a conflict between the royal house and the parliament. Now remember, in England, they started what is called a bicameral system of legislation. That is, where you have two houses. Now, we have the same thing in our country. We have the House of Representatives, we have the Senate. Here in the state of California, we have the Assembly and we have the Senate. And in England, you have the House of Commons and you have the House of Lords. And the House of God. Well, he points out after James died, Charles the First came, and he repeated the same mistakes of his father, but even to a greater degree. Now, in the Church of England, there was a split, and the split was between the Puritans, or the low church, and the high church people. Now the high church wanted to keep more and more toward Roman Catholicism. Now they didn't want to go back under the Pope. That's not what we're saying. But they believed that there should be absolute royal power, and they believed that church should be a very high and liturgical. I think you understand what I'm talking about. A liturgy is where you go through forms, formally. But the Puritans were, on the contrary, people that believed in a pure life. In other words, they wanted purity. And they wanted absolutely nothing to do with anything that hinted of Catholicism. Well, when Charles attempted to force his brand of high church Anglican religion on the Presbyterian subject of Scotland, they promptly took up arms against the king. Boy, you have to go to Scotland to understand how they feel. Ah, like I told you, where John Knox preached, there was a preacher that tried to read from the English Common Prayer Book, and this woman picked up her chair and threw it at that preacher. And they said that's the last time anybody ever tried to read the English Common Prayer Book in a Presbyterian church in Scotland. That just, boy, that rang. I was talking to a Scotsman one time, and he was showing me a cannon. He said, the English took this cannon to repair and they sent it back 300 years later, and still wasn't. I didn't realize how the people in the United Kingdom felt about England until I, got into service. I was hitchhiking one time, and a South African nurse gave me a ride. And, I was just making conversation. I said something about you English. I thank you, young man, not to call me an Englishman. You will find that 90% of South Africans are anti-British. No, I'm sorry, lady, I didn't. Yeah. But you go to Ireland, you go to Scotland, you go to Australia, you go to any of those countries, man, they are really riled at the English. It's this air of superiority. I don't know if it ever rankles you for somebody to come around and pose to be superior to you, but it does me. I feel like I'm not inferior to anybody. I'm not superior to anybody, but brother, I pull my pants on one leg at a time just like the rest of the world. And I'm not impressed by some of these that want to impress me.
Second World War, those good hard-named soldiers to cope with the demons because they would brag about them.
Oh, I would buy an English anti-aircraft battery. Hey, Yoink! Bought a plane. And I said, no. Guys, just like you. All you ever think of is wine, whiskey, and women. And I thought, just because I don't want some tea, I'm out here thinking of wine, whiskey, and women. That's it.
No. Boy, that's a pretty good point.
Well, yeah. You go to England. They don't even know what iced tea is. You just couldn't get her to make any iced tea to save your life. Oh, no. I'm going to give you such a chop. Well, they serve their milk, they serve their soft drink, everything. And I understand in their pub, their beer is on. I didn't investigate that. All right, now, when Charles came to the throne, he tried to get Parliament to vote money so that he could conduct his war against Scotland. But they wouldn't do it. And in 1642, there was a civil war erupted, and the leader of that civil war, the Puritan, was Oliver Cromwell. You need to keep his name in mind because he played a very important role in English history. Cromwell was a Puritan, and he despised the Catholic Church. He despised the High Church of England. And he especially despised Charles' wife because she would wear a large crucifix. And, you know, any of, he used to talk about that papist. in 1646, the king had surrendered, and for the next 2 years, he tried to play off his enemies, the Scots, the Presbyterians, who dominated Parliament, and the independents who dominated the army. Now, Cromwell invaded Ireland. Now, what we see in Ireland right now is directly related to Cromwell. Cromwell went into Northern Ireland and decimated the Catholics, but when he did, he brought in the Scots and settled them in Northern Ireland. Now that's where you get your Scotch-Irish. And these people that followed Cromwell began to call themselves Orange Men. I mean, they had orange banners. And today, they still have these Orange Men parades and so forth. And the Presbyterian Church is dominant in North Ireland. And now, Southern Ireland, the Irish Free State, is Catholic. The Catholics, of course, are the ones that are behind the IRA, the Irish Republican Army. And they want Northern Ireland to become part of the Republic of Ireland. But once they do, if they ever do, that means that the Catholic Church will dominate. Now, in the North, the Presbyterians dominate. If you want the good jobs, you have to be a Presbyterian. You go over to Utah. If you want a good job, you have to be a Mormon. If you want to be a semi-slave, why, you go over there and be a Baptist. The same thing is true in North Ireland. Their laws and their companies are set up to favor the Presbyterians. Now, you see, that's where I find fault with both sides, and I'm Irish. And the reason is that I don't think that religious tests should be the way that you determine whether a guy works or not. When you have a state church, you're going to have that problem. You have a church that is sanctioned by the state. Well, after all, where are you going to get your money? You're going to get your money from the state. Who runs the state? The church. And so, it is intertwined. Now, if you allow these other churches, it is going to drain off members, it's going to drain off money, it's going to drain off a lot of things that they want. Well, anyway, Cromwell became the virtual dictator of England. Now, it started out, we're going to, you know, overthrow this Roman Catholicism, these ten, but you see, he started out with religious toleration for all Protestants, but It was impossible, however, to reconcile the Independents, the Presbyterians, the High Church, and other religious factions. The last three years of Cromwell's life were filled with disappointment and trouble. The extreme Puritan colleagues muzzled the press, forced it on a pleasure-loving people, hateful prohibitions. How would it be if we passed a law that you couldn't have a dance in Southern California? Well, I'm not going to go to any dances, but by the same token, I cannot make you stop it by passing the law. If I do, then I've got to have a way of policing it. Well, a lot like this unpopular business of odd even on gas. Well, most guys, you want the gas? Pump it. I've got gas to sell, you've got money to buy, let's get together again. The only way that they would do anything is if you drove in and the guy said to you, well, I'm sorry, and you started putting up some kind of an argument or a fight, then he might call the police and you would be in trouble for breaking a very unpopular law. But even the sheriffs of different counties said, we're not going to be around policing this thing. We're not going to spend our time. But you can understand, it gripes the fire out of me for people to stand around and blow smoke at them. I sneeze, I wheeze, and so forth. But what if I were in a position that I could just pass a law that you couldn't have cigarettes? Man, my, you know, there'd be a rebellion. I know an old man that is absolutely crippled up with arthritis so bad that they have to help him in bed and out of bed, and, you know, all that. And they've told him that you're not going to get any better as long as you smoke 4 or 5 packs of cigarettes a day. And, well, I really need to quit then. And he did. I had one lady that had a circulation problem. They traced it directly to her smoking. They cut one leg off. And the last time I saw that lady, she was sitting on the side of a hospital bed waiting for them to cut the other leg off. But by the grace of God, she died that night. And I buried her just a one-legged woman instead of a no-legged woman. But she would not quit smoking. Well, of course, her argument was, well, it's too late now, you know. I know a man in Washington. He started smoking when he was 6 years old. I saw him the other day, and every breath was just, you know, emphysema. And I know I ought to quit. Now, if I passed the law and told that man, you know, his son in the church here, man, he'd get cigarettes some way. He'd smoke. Well, I think we need to understand that you cannot legislate righteousness, is what I'm saying. I mentioned before Bethany, Oklahoma, where the Nazarene, they fixed it where you couldn't have a dance, and you couldn't sell, you couldn't keep your drugstore open on Sunday, and you couldn't do this, and you couldn't do that. Boy, they were going to have them a perfect town. The only thing was Oklahoma City right there. And when their kids got to driving, why, if they couldn't get it in Bethany, they just drove across the city line and they got it in Oklahoma City. And it was forbidden. And that made it sweeter than ever.
Yeah, I think about it myself. what people raised in places trying to make a town airtight. It just don't work.
Well, O.L. Jaggers was going to do that, you know, at the World Church.
No, I don't even do that.
No, no. You see, we are in the world. We are not, you know, we're not of the world, but we need to live in the world. And if we could isolate ourselves, it'd be wrong. You see, that, how can you change? Well, it's like I use that illustration of the salt. If we're the salt of the earth, we've got a touch. You know, salt's not going to do any good as long as it stays in the salt chain. You got to put it on the food before it'll season the food. If we're going to touch the world, we're going to have to get that salt shaker and start salting it around with it.
You got to be with that. Now you can
just
this
stuff
and come off.
No, I don't. You know how Christ felt when he went in the temple and made the money change and turned over all the papers.
All right.
But we got to go one time, he showed a little.
And he took a whip, whipped him out.
Yeah, I mean, he threw the tables over and he
but again, they were making God's house.
Yeah.
A house of merchandise. And that's what burns me up about this Reverend Ike and these guys we were talking about yesterday, is that they have literally made a religion a racket.
Yeah.
And they are, it's a demeaning thing.
Look at Ike. That man got lots of money. He don't own the church. You don't have a church.
No.
I'm going to be at the Pacific Auditorium in Long Beach. And he just talk and run his mouth. I want you to meet me there. He's on the radio. His mailing address is in New York.
Yeah.
He lives down in Washington.
He lives in Washington?
No, he got a
house. Oh, well, I understood he lived in New York City. I guess he lives about anywhere.
Yeah.
He probably has houses everywhere.
Yeah, everywhere.
Like
yeah.
The Shaw, he's got.
Yeah, he's just another Shaw.
Yeah. But anyway, I think that Oliver Cromwell is a case in history, a study case. And people ought to really understand the principle. Here was a man that his motives were good. I just want to purify life. But you don't purify life until the heart is pure. I can pass all the laws in the world that I have to love my neighbor. But until I come in contact with the love of God, I'm not going to love my neighbor. I'm going to sit around and plot. Well, I've got to put on here, you know, that I like this guy. But I hate him, and so I'm going to get my dog to bite him or something. I can't be overt about it, but the heart has to change. If the heart changes, then you have something to work on. You have a new nature. But you see, the idea has always been, we got to work at the other end. We got to pass a law that everybody share and share alike in the money. Well, that doesn't work. You know. Even the communist countries, they have the guys in the cars and the big wheels, and they got the little ones. And the only difference between a communist country and our, they don't have any middle class. They got the poor and the rich. The same thing is true in Latin America. You go down in the Catholic country, you're either poor or you're rich.
I'm learning. I know this called come get me. I jump up early, an hour early, run over, pick him up in his family, take him to church. He didn't have his car. Mm-hmm. And I did this for about a month. And finally, he got his car. Welfare got his car. Took his whole check, got his car. And he just said, son, oh, you got it. I want to get up. He got up. On that Saturday, went to Riverside.
Yeah.
Went to Riverside and got up Sunday morning and went out motorbike riding. Fell off a hill and I went somebody yesterday, his leg was in a yep, he had a horn, his yep, his arm and a bandage.
Oh,
and I said, I'm gonna be here. Well, I was gonna go to church out there, but he wouldn't be
good. No, no. You would have been
when
out
he
there.
Got dry, he took all my clothes out. Mm-hmm. That's it.
But again, I have.
Just love to say, you know, he just did all this. I know I'm gonna show him I'm gonna come to church.
I have found the more I do for people, the less appreciative they are.
I'm like Peter now. When is enough?
Yeah.
Lord, until seven times?
That was my father that did that. And he's just telling you the story of my dad.
Oh, that
you know. Yeah. And the little kid, you know, says, well, how long do I have to come to church to pay for those clothes? But he just repeating the story that he heard from Brother Canavan. That rat thing didn't even give me credit for it. It was my father. Dwight Patterson.
Oh. He's supposed to tell all the Bible.
Yeah, and I told the story. I've told a lot of times. Because it illustrates. I think it illustrates, you know, what a kid, the way we're going to buy somebody. You know, the Mormon church does that. Boy, we'll feed them and house them. So on those. That's not going to work.
They tell me the bus minister to put a quarter on the seat. The kids tear down that bus and give them find their quarter on the seat.
But Dwight used to have, let's see, what was it? Somebody, whatever it was, he had one of those gallon jars full of coins, mostly pennies. And whatever the kid that won, whatever it was, every time he got to reach down in there and get a handful of money. All he could hold in his hand, you know, bringing his fist out through that fruit jar or whatever it was. but again, it was mostly pennies. And there was a church not far from us. It used to be called Delta Avenue. But anyway, I don't know what it is. I think it's St. John's now or something. But anyway, the community changed over there. But when it was Delta Avenue, they used to have theater seats, and they had the prize, and they have a drawing. They'd draw a seat number, and you got a $5 bill if you were sick.
Bingo.
Yeah, and they would give away parakeets. It was just unbelievable.
Well, the Catholic got a big sign on there to bingo every Friday night.
Oh, yeah, well, there's a Jewish organization over here on Atlantic that has a great big outfit right there at Atlantic and Carson. And they just have bingo all the time over there.
You know, see this in every phase of territory. This way we usually get life as little kids, you know, real faithful. Anyway, this one little boy has been coming for a long time, but he kept losing the Bible and I was using one. Of course, one of the church members loaned him his sister's Bible, white Bible and everything else. And we have
down underneath the seat there. Been there for a couple of months. So I finally took it and brought it in there and gave it to this guy. I said, here's your sister's body. He said, where did you get that? I said, oh, I've been out there in the van for months, you know. And he said, you know, he said, I loaned that to that little kid. He said he'd take good care of that Bible and everything else. You know, he didn't even talk to me no more. He had lost the Bible, yeah, just like he did the one before.
Oh, we had the same problem. You know, we tried to supply a Bible. We bought a bunch of Bibles for about a dollar and a quarter. The Best Buy I ever made, though, are the Pew Bibles.